Hi, and welcome to the Future of Dermatology podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Farah Kamangar, board-certified dermatologist. We are here to talk about anything and everything dermatology-related. You'll hear from me and my guests, who are dermatologists, physicians, experts, scientists, residents, and medical students in the field of dermatology. We publish weekly, so if you like what you hear, hit that subscribe button and show us some love, and thank you for joining us.
Welcome to the Future of Dermatology podcast. We're so excited today to have Dr. Kira Barr. I'm really excited about what we're going to be talking about. First, of course, we need to catch up and hear about all the amazing things you've been doing. So I, of course, know Dr. Barr from a while back now, from UC Davis. That was, what year was that actually? That was maybe, gosh, I'd have to think back, 2013, maybe 2012.
2012. Yeah, 2012.
We were 21 then. Yeah. But yeah, so, you know, we were very much in an academic practice. Our best dermatopathologists learned so much. And now I'm just seeing all these amazing things you're doing. So I'd love to first, before getting into our topic of anti-aging, which I'm so excited to talk to you about, I'd love just a few minutes just to hear about your amazing journey. It's probably hard to condense it down to a few minutes, but...
Yeah, I definitely have, once I left UC Davis, took a very non-traditional route. I worked with a startup company and created an app for tracking UV exposure over time. And I was so excited, you know, the day it was going to launch in the app store is the day the startup shut down. Paul Allen decided, nope, we don't need this. And, you know, being in medicine where everything is very, there's safety, there's security. It was my first startup experience. I was like, oh my God, what are all the people going to do? So that was very eye-opening. And also that, like, V1, let's just get V1 out. We don't care. And I'm like, oh my gosh, in medicine, if you don't pay attention to what's in V1, like, you kill people, right? So it was just like this.
It's so true. The rollout of things in medicine is so slow versus how fast tech moves. It's so true.
Yes. Yes. So eye-opening. And then I went down the fashion line for a little while and tried to make fashionable sun protective clothing and realized I was not a fashion designer. So I still have all the prototypes and all the things, still waiting for sun protective clothing to become fashionable. But I realized that I would need a lot of support now. And along the way, as I was doing all this fun and exciting things, my own health really started to fall apart. Actually, when I left UC Davis, it was my going away party and then going into the OR suite to have the early melanoma cut out of my arm. And that really was my first wake-up call that my body, my skin was talking to me, and I was completely deaf to it. I was also running ultramarathons at the time, you know, juggling an academic career and kids. And I was in chronic pain, and I had just been ignoring all the signs and symptoms. And so along this path, so first it was the spot on my arm, and then it was gut issues, hormonal issues, and our colleagues just couldn't connect the dots. The symptoms, you know, weren't making sense. And so it really led me down the path of functional medicine, alternative medicine, really down to mind-body medicine, and really understanding the role that stress, unmanaged stress, unresolved trauma, how it gets stored in the body, and the connection between the body, the brain, the skin, and our hormones. And it really led me to where I am now, which is really trying to bridge the gap between mental health and skin health from a trauma-informed lens, right? So the field of psychodermatology has existed for quite some time, but really, it's more cognitive behavioral therapy, so talk therapy, and prescription. And those have a place. But for some people, there is a limit to how much it can help. And so where I find myself now is in this, trauma healing space of body-oriented, body-centered approaches that it's basically body-based talk therapy in many ways. Because as trauma researchers like Gabor Mate and Hessel Fahrendelock have brought to light, trauma is stored in the body. So the way I help people now is really working with the body to help heal the skin.
That's incredible. And I think so much of our mind shift are just shifting from the traditional way we used to do things. I think a lot of docs are kind of coming around to this mindset. And with dermatology too, like in a practice, in a clinic day, you could see 30 people look at their skin. And we don't have a lot of time to the setting and the insurance and all this stuff. It's not the perfect setup for it. But there's so much you miss when you're just looking at that one thing, just the skin, and you're ignoring all this other aspects of it too. So that's an amazing journey of you kind of discovering all these, just kind of being a holistic physician rather than looking at that one thing. And that's it, which is probably why people can't sometimes figure out symptomology, because they're maybe looking at just one organ or one system and kind of ignoring all these other signs.
I think, you know, it goes back to Descartes, right? Like the mind is separate from the body. And then that is how medicine kind of in many ways wound up, where we have siloed the body, but we are still one human being. And all the systems are still interconnected. And it's a matter of recognizing that and seeing how can we look at the whole big picture. But what's so fascinating too is I think back to the essay that I wrote to even get into dermatology, and it stems back to this very same path of, you know, I was always struck by the passage that Primo Levi had written in his book, The Survival of Auschwitz. So he was a Holocaust survivor, and he wrote about this concept of how he felt like he was at his bottom when he had been stripped of his belongings, his dignity, his family, of everything, and he wound up at the bottom. And for me, obviously, I'm not trying to equate a Holocaust survivor's journey with that of someone living with a visible chronic skin or hair issue. But in that own way, in a society that judges us based on our appearance and assigns our value and our worth based on how we look, it is not uncommon that people wind up at their own version of the psychological bottom, own version of their despair and hopelessness on a daily basis. And I always felt like that is how I wanted to serve in dermatology. It was to help support people to raise them up from their bottom, to help bring them to their version of the top. Because as a kid, I was brutally made fun of for birthmarks that were on my skin. I mean, kids are so mean, right? They call me coffee stain face. But you know, it's because I had these cafe au lait spots, you know, one on each of my face. And it's so funny because like kids are a-holes. Kids are. They were right. Like they were coffee stains, cafe, but they were right. But because of that experience, it had such a profound impact on me. And so I've just kind of come full circle to that journey.
That's incredible. And actually that's a good transition into, we were chatting earlier. So there was one post that you had posted where, and I was like, oh my gosh, this is amazing. We have to talk about this. I'm going to read it out loud and feel free to speak more on it. You posted, you see, anti-aging is one of the most harmful phrases and it's time we stop using it. And I just think it's so timely. One, it's sort of what does anti-aging even mean? Like, why are we against aging? And then aging, of course, has been added to the ICD diagnostic criteria as well. Maybe it's a good thing because a lot of science is coming out of it, and senolytics and all these different molecules to kind of stop aging, quote, just kind of try to live as long as we can and defer all disease until we can. But it's such a loaded word, and you just wonder if it has any value anymore, if we should be using it. And I feel like it's a good time to talk about these things. In the past few years, there's been a lot of kind of social change and terms being tossed out, terms being changed. Is it time that we get rid of this one? So I'd love to just hear more about your post and behind that. And
I mean, this has been an ongoing conversation, at least for the last, you know, 5-6 years, you know, and alternatives to what should we say? And I think in general, you know, we talk about like, and so someone actually responded to this post and said, but what about anti-inflammatory? Should we be, you know, and I'm like, it's not the same thing. Inflammation is harmful can cause harm. Aging is actually, depending on how you choose to live your life, like, you know, aging doesn't, in and of itself, doesn't harm your well-being. You can make lifestyle choices. You can make choices for yourself so that you age in the most healthful way possible. Not the same thing. My point of discussion, and you know, that's really what I'm hoping to do, is spark a conversation, is like, when you say that you're anti-aging, it's why would I want to be anti anything about myself? Because that just makes me feel ashamed and anxious and impacts my self-esteem. And we know that the brain and skin are intimately connected, right? They're embryologically linked. If I'm talking negatively about myself, that is activating my stress response. It's increasing my stress hormones like cortisol, yeah? Which is going to prevent collagen production. It's going to break it down. It's going to damage my DNA. It's going to shorten my telomeres. It's going to make me older. Like, what the, you know what I mean? Like, it's just the antithesis. So I just think that a lot more harm can be done in the language that we use. That's one of the things that one of my favorite professors at University of Michigan always said. He's like, words matter. How you say what you want to say matters. Same thing with how we perceive and talk about the gift of aging. That doesn't mean that shouldn't, that can't include Botox, fillers, and aesthetics.
Right.
But because we talk about that aging is something that should be feared or rebelled against, or, you know, it's shameful. Now we have so many, I would say the male aesthetic market has grown, but I think for the most part, those of us socialized as women have been impacted for a much longer time with this term. And especially the clients that I work with, they've done the Botox, they've done the fillers, they've done the tummy tucks, they're on the GLP-1 agonist, you know, losing the weight.
Okay, they probably look fabulous, but go on.
Fabulous, but they feel terrible, and they keep, you know, the big question is, I've done all these things. Do you love me now?
Right.
Do you like me now?
Yeah.
And that's heartbreaking. That's devastating. Because they were doing these things because they thought they had to for someone else. It's a whole different story if you look in the mirror and you're like, all right, I see you wrinkles, I see you sagging. I love who you are beneath the surface, and I want to celebrate all of you. I want you to look as good as I feel about myself. Let's do the Botox. Let's do the fillers. Let's have the procedure. Then that is money well spent, because you're doing it from a place of self-care, self-love perhaps, versus self-loathing. You will never get your return on your investment from that perspective. And I think that's where the word anti-aging has created the most harm, because there's this, it's big money in the beauty industry, you know, sort of benefiting, but at what cost to the human?
Yeah, if anything, at this point, it's more of a marketing word, isn't it, than like any actual medical link to anything at all. And then this interesting thing between the cosmeceutical world and then sort of the anti-aging. And sometimes that seems the same, but it's almost not, because there's this whole line of research going on towards anti-aging in the sense of longevity, beating off disease, holding off these chronic diseases that can happen with just chronological aging. Then there is all the cosmeceutical things, like changing your face and changing your wrinkles, which I also do. I do all of these in clinic. I'm not, you know, saying it in any sort of judging of any.
Listen, I'd be a hypocrite, you know, if I said I've never had Botox or filler, or I don't plan to do Botox in the future. That's not what I'm saying at all, right? It's the intentionality behind it, and it's what we make it mean for ourselves about ourselves, right? So these wrinkle, you know, and there's ways, like I totally agree with you in terms of health span. And even Peter Attia's book, you know, Outlive, he makes a really interesting point about his perspective on longevity for the longest time. What he was trying to accomplish, hack longevity. But for what purpose? My wife doesn't like, you know, his wife, you know, he was saying about his mental and emotional health had been put on the back burner and he was miserable, but he was living longer, right? This is not an either or, this is a both and. Can we age and take care of all parts of ourselves? The physical, the mental, the emotional. It matters. But if you're anti, then your motivation, you're going to kind of gloss over or push to the back burner the things that will make that life feel richer, more enjoyable, fuller, because we wind up numbing. We wind up like pushing away.
And don't you feel like it's like a losing battle? So if you start to longevity and living well, those are attainable goals. You'll always, for whatever day it is, you're living the best you can. Anti-aging is like a losing battle. You're going to age regardless of what you're doing. So it's almost like an inevitable setting yourself a failure type of thing. So you're like, I'm not doing the right anti-aging because then it creates like almost the competition whole thing. Like, well, this person's aging better and that person is. So it's interesting. The mindset is so interesting that it creates all these artificial sort of things in our heads.
Absolutely. That's such a good point. Like, yeah, you're setting yourself up for failure day in, day out because you are aging. And there's already, for so many of us, our core belief is already, I'm not good enough. There's something wrong with me, right? And that stems back to our childhood and attachment. I'll think, like, we could go there too. But like, for so many of us, you know, that's a common belief. And now we're just reinforcing that. We're just reinforcing it day in, day out, saying, I'm not supposed to be who I am. But this is who I am. I am aging.
It's just more negative self-talk just thrown in the mix. So I'd be curious. So I do a lot of general dermatology still. I do a lot of like cosmetics as well. The cosmetic consultation is always just such an interesting thing. And recently, actually, we recruited nurses in our practice to help us with that. Because I think innately it always turns into, and I don't mean to kind of put it in a negative term, but it's sort of that vibe of maybe that psychodermatology type of visit. There is this heavy psych component, whether you address it or not, it's in the room, right? And I don't mean the very classic, like some people just come in and they're like, I've been getting Botox for 10 years, love it, just here, do it here and done, and that's it. But this is the more person coming in and saying, you know, I haven't done a lot. I don't want to do anything. But also, can you change my whole face and what would that look like? You know, and then you kind of start unwrapping that. And why are we doing that? Why now? And there's always a reason behind it. Something, you know, kind of got them to build that inertia to actually, as opposed to just watching things online and things like that, talking to friends, making an appointment and coming in to try to change something kind of substantial. And then there's the piece I find, which I think for physicians is, so there's that piece of just how do you address the psychological component with the short amount of times that we have and the lack of skill set and lack of tools. I mean, that's not a lot of things that's going to talk to us. Unless maybe you are a psychiatrist, then maybe that field taught more tools to the physician. Then the other piece of it, which I always find interesting, is the cash pay aspect. It's a piece in medicine. We don't know it. We're not comfortable with that. I think physicians are not comfortable about talking about money and things like that. But past even that, I find it interesting the putting value to the procedure. It's almost like this strange bartering of like, okay, well, this one, how much more collagen am I going to build? And is it worth that kind of amount of money? It's like all these little artificial things that, you know, we're set on a business side, of course, you're putting a value on it with your staff and the overhead and this and that. But from the patient standpoint, they're not thinking about that. They're thinking about where does this get me from this point of anti-aging to this other point of anti-aging? And like monetarily, what is that worth? And the whole concept, I think you could, we do these consults all day long, all day out. We do the procedures. People are happy the procedures work. But I think if you kind of really took that cosmetic consultation and broke it down, there's just so much there that like there's just so many pieces of psychology and the physiology and all of that and all of the social aspects that kind of go into it. It's like a very loaded visit, I think, which is what makes it difficult, inherently difficult.
No doubt. And we weren't trained. Most of us did not have a lot of experience with psychodermatology. You know, it was always often a referral out to psychiatry or psychology, and then there was stigma involved. And I'll name that I've spent the last, I don't even know how many years, taking courses, educating myself, and who I am surrounded by and who my current mentors are psychologists. And some psychiatrists, but mostly licensed therapists of all different sorts in the somatic space. And there really is a need to help bring this education forward. So I have spoken at the American Academy of Dermatology and the Psychocutaneous Association patient advocacy groups about bringing, you know, this type of conversation forward, because sitting in that room may very well be someone who has body dysmorphia that stems from, you know, their own trauma, their own core wounds from back there, back then. And no matter what you do for them, it may not be enough. So before, you know, that's why it is so important to have a consultation before you do a procedure to understand someone's motivation, because they may need some support and counseling prior to having that procedure, right? So that they actually get the support that they need.
Yeah, it's so interesting. And I think our physiology and our science is changing so much too, in showing the links between the inflammatory markers crossing the blood-brain barrier and causing mood changes. And I think that kind of that stigma hopefully is going away on the physician side, I feel like. Hopefully it's also happening on the patient side. But I think physicians in the past, you know, there's a person that you would see kind of picking their skin, for example, and you would think, oh, well, that's, you know, in their head, so to speak, right? And sent to psychiatry. Whereas now we know, well, maybe that's a subset of prurigo nodularis. And we now know the nerves literally have inflammatory markers on them. And then we always kind of assume eczema or psoriasis, of course, their skin is covered. And that's why a person, it might be depressed or have low mood. But we now know the inflammatory markers across the blood-brain barrier and can cause depression. And so it's sort of like it's not in their head necessarily, you know, so to speak. They're not making it up. It's just physiological things that people are feeling. It's really interesting around the trauma research. I'm sure this exists. I don't know it well, but I'm sure they kind of probably have it where it literally, there's probably neural networks, I'm guessing, that they can kind of map back to where there's like physiological changes.
Absolutely. There is an end. You know, I think we need more of it in more of this research in dermatology. I'm actually going to be hopefully soon moving forward with a study looking at hidradenitis suppurativa and self-compassion, right? How can we bring more healing there? This is a patient population that really struggles with a lot of shame and isolation and discomfort. And because, you know, most people can't visibly see because it's covered by clothing, but they are really struggling and feeling there's medical trauma from the procedures that they have to undergo. And then there's the emotional scars as well. But what's fascinating, there was a study on psoriasis, looking at psoriasis and complex PTSD. And what they found is that individuals who had experienced neglect and verbal abuse, maybe physical abuse as kids, and then there were additional life stressors as adults, they had more severe symptoms, more itch, more plaques. And so there is a correlation. And even the studies that were done by Jon Kabat-Zinn back in the 90s, looking at psoriasis using a mindfulness-based stress reduction model and phototherapy. So it was MBSR for short, and phototherapy versus just phototherapy alone. Those individuals who were taught the skills of mindfulness meditation and some of the practices like some yoga, they had not only a clinical improvement, but also on the quality, like a quality of life improvement as well. And this is the exact reason that I created somatic skincare program, because it goes beyond just MBSR, which is mindfulness-based stress reduction. Mindfulness is really paying attention with intention to your present moment experience. Yeah? What somatics is How am I feeling in my body in this present moment during this experience? So it really, because you can, with mindfulness, you can still get stuck in your head and be like, oh, you know, I'm aware that I'm anxious. I don't like that I'm anxious. And then you just have a conversation of like, I'm anxious, right? But with somatics, it's like, okay, where in my body am I feeling that sensation? What does it feel? And it brings you inside, reconnects you to yourself, gets you out of your head into your body. And it has been shown to be a proven modality for helping release stress, you know, relieve the trauma for many people, especially in the setting of complex post-traumatic stress, so that it's more post-traumatic growth versus ongoing disorder. So it's really a different approach than has been used. And I feel like it's really necessary to bring this into the fold of dermatology. And granted, not most of our colleagues, they don't have the bandwidth, the time. It doesn't fit into the traditional medical model, the way the healthcare system is set up. But we can collaborate. We can connect and be able to offer our patients the support that they need and deserve.
Yeah, it's fantastic what you're doing. Even that study you mentioned with phototherapy, but if you add the mindfulness component and the awareness, your therapy is so much better, but we just completely ignore that, right? We're just like, just go to phototherapy. And when you're doing kind of better, we'll just taper down a little bit. So it's actually, when you kind of put it in that frame of mind, it's kind of insane that we're not addressing like a very well-known part of it. I had this thought one time when I was injecting this really young person on their hands with just a bunch of Botox for their ulnar hyperhidrosis. And that's a condition where we know your sweat glands are absolutely fine. You have the same number of sweat glands. They're functioning the same way as anyone else's, but it's that innervation that it's that for whatever reason, that stressor, whatever is going on with your body versus someone else's body. And we know these feedback type of therapies do work. But what we do instead is, you know, try all these other things and pills. And if you take the pill enough where you can't pee anymore, okay, come in and I'll just poke you in your hand. Like a lot of pills. And it hurts. And patients will do it just because they're miserable, you know, with their social interactions. They need to do it. And I literally remember there's this patient I was injecting halfway through, just looking miserable. And I'm like, what good am I doing, right? I mean, in the short term, you'll be okay for 3 to 4 months. But there's so much being ignored here. But like you say, there's no quick fix as to where would you send a referral to, because the system isn't set up for that. But the work you're doing is really starting to change that. And I think hopefully more and more kind of systems will start to kind of adopt these models. It's kind of, even a few years ago at our practice, we tried to do this co-thing with our psychiatry department, but then it came down to, well, who bills it and what happens and all the logistical kind of back end to it. But the correct care, you know, when patients ask, what would you do for yourself? What would you do for your mom or your loved one? This is what you'd want to do, right? Like, not ignore half of what's going on with the patient.
For me, I'm outside the medical model. I work one-on-one with people, but I also lead groups. And I think there's value, there's power in groups. I mean, there's loneliness is an epidemic. And especially in the cancer literature, here's where it's so interesting. And I had presented this at the AAD meeting, excuse me, the role that traumatic stress, chronic stress plays in the cancer biology life cycle, and skin cancer being the most prevalent cancer in the United States, right? We are not even addressing the role, you know, for our patients that stress plays. But if you look at the literature, it has been shown that cancer cells have beta adrenergic receptors on them. So when our stress response is activated, cortisol goes up, adrenaline goes up, it is feeding the cancer cells. And in the literature, it has shown that chronic stress, traumatic stress plays a role in cancer formation, progression, metastasis, and impacts treatment and survival. But the beautiful thing is they looked at studies using mind-body skills groups, similar to some of the modalities that I do teach. And they looked at melanoma patients, and the fear of recurrence went down, their anxiety levels went down. They it doesn't change their diagnosis, but it helps the experience of living with the diagnosis and how to have a thriving, fuller life living with cancer. Yeah. And I think it's something that should be part of every discussion and conversation. We know that stress is driving our inflammatory response.
Absolutely.
Eczema, acne, psoriasis, some of the most common things, alopecia, right? Scleroderma, for instance. This drives me bonkers. There was an article last November, I think it was a CME article on scleroderma, beautifully written. It was all about the pathophysiology and all the treatments on the, not one mention about stress or trauma. Dr. Gabor Mate actually brings it up, and I think in his book, When the Body Says No. And I looked at the literature too, because I was like, why is this missing? I actually wrote a letter, a commentary, and it didn't get published and I was so pissed because the reviewer was like, you know, then you have to talk about stress with all the diseases. I was like, why? This is a review on scleroderma. Why are you? I could, but then it would be like, it won't be just a one paragraph. I'm going to write you a whole thing that would be the same as the journal. I was so angry. But the whole point, if you think about it, autoimmune diseases, the literature has shown like upwards of 70% of autoimmune conditions affect women. And when you look further into that, a good proportion of that population has suffered some sort of abuse, verbal abuse, physical abuse. What is scleroderma? If you think about it, it's a literal shield, protection. And it was at one of the derm meetings, I think it was at the integrative derm meeting. He's a hypnotherapist, actually, and he shared the story that on his wife's deathbed, she never talked about it before. She died of scleroderma. And it was only when she was literally about to die that she was able to acknowledge, yes, I was abused. How many people are suffering in silence and literally trying to protect themselves? Like, our skin is our ultimate barrier. Yeah, it protects us from the outside world. And trauma happens in relationship. It can be healed in relationship, but it's a boundary violation. Your skin is like the visible manifestation of a boundary violation, right? Our skin gets leaky, that gut-skin connect. So much, if we think about the skin from just a different perspective, it makes so much sense why things show up. Of course your skin is flaring, right? We think about like things like herpes or acne when we're stressed. Like, think about the physiology. It's not woo-woo. There's actual science to this, but we have to address to be able to help our patients. This is part of why they're not getting better. They're not complying because they're not feeling seen, heard, or validated for what's really happening beneath the surface. And I'm not saying my way is the only way. What I'm saying is it's a both and. They need the medication. They need some of the traditional treatments. And also the mental and emotional piece that goes beyond talk therapy and, you know, prescription medications, healing from a body-centered oriented approach is really helpful. So to be able to treat our patients mind, body, and spirit, you know.
The scleroderma example is incredible. It's literally when something happens to you and you're like, just get tougher skin. That's literally tougher skin. It's crazy. I've never actually like thought about it that way. That's actually incredible to think about. And the fibroblasts that are all dysfunctional in that condition, there's so much coming out now about the science of fibroblasts now. They've kind of been ignored, I think, for the longest time, but they do have all these receptors on them. Like, they are affected by stress, and they are, I mean, it's kind of incredible when you start thinking about that science connection of it. It also kind of makes me think of just physicians in general. I don't necessarily love the word burnout and all that. I think that's more negative self-talk as well, but it's there. Whatever's happened, that phenomenon is there. But it's just, there's so much of it, I think, being thrown out there now that I think physicians are like, well, maybe I should be burnt out, you know, even when they're not. But sometimes, you know, when physicians are tired, whether it's the female physicians or male, then they're also kind of, you know, we'll toughen up, gain more skills, get tougher, you know, tougher skin, so to speak. So it's not surprising that a lot of physicians are at some point developing some sort of physical symptom of all these years of just work and stress. And
because we have been conditioned to just push through and ignore the signs and symptoms and signals that our body is offering us. Our bodies are incredibly wise, and it's our opportunity to pay attention, to attune. And so to your point, a few of the contras I've spoken about, you know, I speak to that as physicians, we are the greatest resource for our patients to be seen, heard, and understood. And so we were taught in medical school and residency that we needed to, the most important skills were like clinical pathologic correlation, how to do the procedure, you know, how to write the prescription. When in fact, it's our presence and our embodiment that is the most important skill we could ever learn. To make a connection with the human who's sitting in front of you in the exam room, right? To be attuned to them, to be able to make sure that they feel safe. That is our primary human need, is a felt sense of safety and connection. We are wired for connection. We are wired for survival, which means that we have to feel safe in order to be able to survive. So teaching physicians how to be embodied, teaching them these very same skills, number one, helps them with their own burnout and exhaustion and fatigue, right? You cannot pour from an empty cup. And it has a ripple effect on being able to better support your patient. Even if you have no idea how to help them, you just being there to listen, that's what so many people need, because they don't have that in their life. No one else is paying attention. No one else understands. So the embodied physician, right? I've led groups of our colleagues through a similar process, and then the same for people, you know, struggling with skin diseases, because we're all humans. We all have stress. We all have anxiety over certain things. We all have life's challenges, and we need the skills, tools, and resources to be able to keep our nervous system regulated. Because it's nervous system dysregulation that throws everything out of balance, disrupts how our immune system functions. It disrupts how our endocrine system functions, right? Everything is connected.
Yeah, and so that's such an important point with the physician-patient encounter too. I think intuitively now it's kind of built to be like on time and this thing. So to the point where if you are taking a longer time to build that connection with your patient in front of you, which is ultimately really probably the connection that will save you both in the long run. But as that connection is being built, that little counter is going up on the clock, the physician's building up more anxiety. He's like, I got to get out of this room. Like, So it's like the opposite is happening. And I mean, we've kind of set it up almost like the anti-aging thing. We've kind of almost set it up as to fail too. The kind of the system we have where it's just kind of like, well, you got to see this many patients and get out in this time and write this many notes. It's almost opposite of an environment that would be conducive to building a relationship or trying to connect. It's an opposite. It's like, please don't connect. Just show me the thing. Let me get out of here.
And here's the thing. It doesn't have to take long. It doesn't have to double the time in your visit. Making a connection is, and eye contact is not always one of them. Depending on how someone's past experience, just because they're not making eye contact with you or you're not making eye contact with them doesn't mean that you're not going to be able to connect. But it's when you are grounded in yourself, when you are regulated, when you have prepared yourself right before you walk in the room, taking a few deep breaths, feeling your feet on the ground, you feel regulated, you walk in and you can have a you know, your presence is just exudes ease, right? We are energetic beings. There are studies that show like the heart and, you know, our heart actually has a greater range of electromagnetic energy. It's like 6 feet out, right? Like, and you know this, I know that sounds a little woo, but like when you walk into a room, you get a vibe. You get a vibe. That
vibe is real.
Right? And so that's what this is. If you can ground yourself, you know, focus on your own presence before the encounter, even while you're sitting in front of the patients while they're activating you, you can even say, hey, like, let's just breathe together, or just literally it could be a 5-minute encounter, but you're engaged, you're present, your patient will feel that. And you can stay on time, right? And you can stay on time, but you have to start with you. This is why I do encourage physicians, you know, and I have taught lots of physicians a lot of these skills, because it starts with you, because we can co-regulate together or we can co-dysregulate together. And when you are dysregulated and your patient is active, and it's like an infinity loop of just stress in that room, and you and they're unhappy and you're behind and you're frustrated, and right?
That's incredible. Thank you so much for all your wisdom and sharing all your teachings. We have to have you come back multiple times. Like each one of these, it's like its own session as well. And then, since this is the Future of Dermatology podcast, we always end with the question of, what one or few things do you think is the future of dermatology?
Oh, well, of course, I would say that, you know, somatic psychoderm, right? It doesn't exist. I'm creating this, right? It is a trauma-informed, body-based approach to help people heal their skin by attuning to how they feel in their body. And what you've created, I think, is the future. I'm going to use that like tonight to
do DermGPT's great.
That's great.
Oh, thank you. It's helpful. But those are the things too. Just the silly little tasks, we got to make those easy.
Yeah.
Just get those out of the way so you have more time to like sit there with a human being and connect.
Yeah. I think, you know, and another thing that I think is the future, and you mentioned it too, just we've touched on it, right? It takes a village, and taking a more of an integrative approach, that skin health and mental health are not separate. Quality of sleep and skin health are not separate. We know that melatonin, cortisol interchange, and melatonin is one of the most potent antioxidants for DNA repair, and that happens in our sleep. Like, I think the future is really looking at the whole person, more personalized medicine. I know that in the traditional medical model, you know, functional, tests that are done in the functional medical space, hopefully will make their way in, so we can really address people's gut health. We can look at the role that maybe genomics, nutrigenomics might play, so that we can make more informed decisions of how to not do cookie cutter treatment, but really support people. And I think it'll be a cost savings overall, right? Because we're really, there's a test, I know we're ending, but just in terms of the mental health space, there's actually a test called the Genomine test. And it looks at your genetics and it pairs it against the anti-anxiolytics and some of the antidepressants to see which drugs are most likely to work for you, right? And we did this with my daughter, actually, and it saved so much trial and error. She was put on an anti-anxiety med and it worked for her, like, you know, and it said like this, it would have taken months, and my poor kid was really struggling. And this is what I'm saying. Yes, I taught her the mind-body skills. Yes, she went to a therapist. And yes, she also benefited from being on a medication. This is not a either or, this is a both and.
Yeah, all of it together. It's true. The personalized medicine piece is, there's so much to it. And that's definitely, everything you're doing is such an important aspect as well. That actually, yeah, like those tests we should, I've gotten really into testing recently. I'm like, what other thing can I test myself with?
I know.
And if you have any, I know we're wrapping up here, but if you have any links or any sites or any more information about this, we can link it below to this episode as well. Just so anyone else read more and find these resources and the tests we should be offering in our clinics.
Yeah. Yeah, my pleasure. My pleasure. This was wonderful. Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to the Future of Dermatology podcast. Remember to hit that subscribe button and share the podcast with your friends. The more you share and subscribe, the more we'll be able to grow and share our dermatology knowledge. If you have burning dermatology questions, feel free to leave them in the comment below, and we would love to address them in a future episode. And please note that this podcast is not intended to substitute for medical advice from your doctor.